And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. My name is Melvin. I want to thank you so much for being here. Episode number 254. So, to be conservative means that you are resistant to change. And I say that not as a slight, but because I know conservatives. And whenever I ask them what sort of the hallmark is of them being conservative, they will say to me, generally, they don't particularly care for change. Why do things have to be this way now when things used to be that way? Why does this have to be now when things used to be that way? Why do we have so many different genders now? So on, so forth, da-da-da-da-da. And their biggest complaint is almost always political correctness. They say, politically correctness is killing America, or some hyperbole similar to that. So it would seem that that should be the thing that drives them. What I'm learning, especially from having another Republican president, and certainly being a lot more woke during this Republican presidency than previous administrations, is it's not merely a resistance or fear of change. It seems to me what may be ultimately driving conservatives, whether consciously or unconsciously, has a lot more to do with race than anything else. Please, allow me to explain. We are effectively back in 1968 right now. And depending on what part of the country that you're in, we're even further back than that. There's a headline that's been going around. I went ahead and pulled the article from Ebony. And the headline says it all. The FBI are investigating a black man found hanging from a tree in Mississippi. At this time, authorities are not releasing any information, and they say that they are not investigating a murder or suicide, and they're not outlining what they're exactly investigating. They say it's a murder. They're gonna get the facts, and then they'll get back to us when they get more facts. The news in the area has been reporting that it's an apparent suicide, but the family of the man, the folks who would know him best, say, no, we definitely don't think it's a suicide. And the gentleman was only 21 years old. So it's not unheard of. Suicide happens every day in our country. I live in Portland, Oregon, the Portland, Oregon area, and we have a fairly high suicide rate. So it's not like it's an unheard of thing, but for a black man to be found hanging from a tree, I suppose that could be him being dramatic on his way out. I did not know him personally, but when I think about black men hanging from trees, I think about the white terrorism of the KKK. I think of intimidation. And this week, and the gentleman's name was Willie Andrew Jones, this past week, we got some more of that intimidation. The thing that I'm hoping will sort of reverse the bad old days this time around is the fact that we've got disruptive technology in the form of cell phones, things that can record audio and video. We've got the internet. So if your face ends up on the internet, it tends to travel around the world a little bit faster. See, the two men that killed Emmett Till in court got up there. We didn't do it. It wasn't us. So on and so forth. Then when they were acquitted, they went ahead and sold their story. They go, yeah, we killed him, that little SOB. But they can't be tried for the same crime twice. So they effectively got away with it. And the point of murdering Emmett Till wasn't necessarily exactly what happened to young Emmett. But it was to spread fear and intimidation among the rest of the African-American community. That they'd better know their place. And they'd better not be so uppity. Because if they are, and that was always the point. Of course, what we learned about the Till story at this time, because of the woman who said she was whistled at by Emmett, has now said, I wasn't whistled at, and I shouldn't have said that. But it's too late. Till is dead. The two men that killed him, they're long dead. Sins of the past, I suppose, right? So we got some new intimidation this past week from a man named Aaron Schlossenberg. I tried not to screw up the last name. I'm sorry. And he was in a New York restaurant. Everybody knows this gentleman's name by now. Oh, hell. We'll just get to the tape.
Your staff is speaking Spanish to customers when they should be speaking.
Being very violent. I mean, sometimes they do.
Every person I listen to, he spoke it, she's speaking it, is American. And my guess is they're not documented. So my next call is to ICE Pad. Out of my country. If they have the to come here and live off of my money, I pay for their welfare, I pay for their ability to be here.
So what you heard there on video, I just got the audio from it. Obviously, you see the video. It's quite a bit more embarrassing. But what you heard him say is, I pay for their welfare, I pay for their this, I pay for their that. If you listen to right-wing radio, and you watch Fox News, and you watch, you know, InfoWars, and all this other crap, they're telling their audience, their hard right-wing racist audience, that the reason taxes are so high, it's not because of the military. It's because of all these brown people that are collecting welfare. It's all the money's going to them. So anytime you see somebody brown eating food, that's why you don't have any money in your pocket, because it's going to, which is a flat-out lie. But Mr. Schlossenberg says right there, he goes, I pay for your welfare. Okay. What we've learned about him after the fact, after this video came out, was there have been hundreds of photos of him. This isn't his first time doing it. It's just his first time doing it in front of a video camera at close range. And of course, this time it went viral. But there are shots of this man at, I almost said Hitler rallies. It's Trump rallies. Sorry. I know. I repeat myself. It's almost one and the same. There are pictures of him with his MAGA hat. There are pictures of him screaming at Mexicans. There are pictures of him screaming at Jews. There are pictures of him screaming at women. And this poisonous idea, this insanely poisonous idea to the rest of us that are not racist, we go, God, love it. Where does this stuff come from? Why do they think this way? Why do they feel this way? And if you're not consuming conservative media at all, this is super foreign to you. But to me, that consumes a ton of conservative media, I've been waiting for this stuff to happen for a while, because these folks are so consumed and so convinced that white is right. They have the right to be here. And then all these brown people, they don't belong here because they're invaders. They're different. They're them. On the part of our politicians, even our conservative politicians, I don't think it has a lot to do with race for them. For them, even the conservatives, I don't think that they're racist. But if you want to divide us, this is a real easy way to divide us. And they've got no trouble using this. The Republican Party, they got no trouble using these issues and not challenging the president when he says these things. Even though Mitch McConnell doesn't get on the floor and say a lot of racist stuff when the president says it, and he is asked about it, and he just sort of defends it, you know, half-heartedly or wholeheartedly, one can only assume that he's completely okay with it. There's a poem that Trump has been reading at his rallies for a while. He read it during the campaign, and now that he's become president, he still reads this particular poem. And if you watch any of the videos of him reading this poem, you see the people behind him in the video mouthing all the words as he reads it. Conservatives, white supremacists, neo-Nazis. Once again, I'm repeating myself. They all know this poem. And it's all about this woman that takes in this injured animal. It's called the snake. She takes in a snake. He talks about the snake's skin. He talks about the... Here. I'm just going to let you hear the poem. And it's meant to be racial. The president is up... So if you find any of the clips, they're about three, four minutes long. Because for about the first minute and a half, 2 minutes, the president is saying, this is about our immigration system. This poem goes out to ICE. This poem is about all these people that are here that shouldn't be here, that are clearly not American. You know, he lets people know up front that it has everything to do with race.
On her way to work one morning, down the path along the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor, half-frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with the dew. Poor thing, she cried, I'll take you in and I'll take care of you. The border. Take me in, oh tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, oh tender woman, sighed the vicious snake. She wrapped him up all cozy in a comforter of silk and laid him by her fireside with some honey and some milk. She hurried home from work that night, and as soon as she arrived, she found that pretty snake she'd taken in had been revived. Take me in, O tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, oh tender woman, sighed that vicious snake. She clutched him to her bosom. You're so beautiful, she cried. But if I hadn't brought you in by now, oh heavens, you would have died. She stroked his pretty skin again and kissed him and held him tight. But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite. Take me in, oh tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, oh tender woman, sighed the vicious snake. I have saved you, cried the woman. And you've bitten me, heavens, why? You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
What he means by the poem is pretty clear. And you can even hear in the audio there people saying the poem along with him, especially when it gets to the more exciting parts of the poem. This week, we got a couple new things from our super-duper racist white supremacist president. The first came in the form of reversing a law that was implemented after the 2008 crash. When it came to home lending, we learned that a lot of African Americans got vastly higher rates than their white counterparts, even when they had really good credit. They still ended up with these much, much higher rates. And with a trend like that, it became pretty clear. The likely explanation had to be their race. We saw the same thing in auto loans. And then this week came this, the headline from USA Today: Trump signs resolution killing rule intended to prevent racial bias in auto lending. Quoting here, auto lenders will once again be allowed to mark up the interest rates on auto loans to sell their cars, a practice critics say is racially discriminatory. After Trump signed a bill striking down a rule discouraging the practice, the Obama administration adopted the rule in 2013 in response to reports that black and Hispanic car buyers were paying higher interest rates on their loans than their white counterparts. These indirect loans come from third-party financial institutions, which returns part of that higher interest rate back to the car dealership. Lenders and car dealers say the system that gives salesmen the flexibility they need to offer discounted auto loans to their best customers. It's the 16th time that Trump has signed a resolution to strike down a regulation under the Congressional Review Act, a formerly obscure law that allows Congress to have final say over these regulations. The House voted to repeal the rule 234-175 and the Senate 51-47. Both sides were largely among party lines, with Democrats voting to keep the rule in place, the rule that would have continued to fight against racial discrimination. Then, of course, not recognizing that he even voted to or that he signed the bill overturning the rule, then we got this from the president.
We have people coming into the country, or trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. But we're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before.
And of course, what the president tried to say when he was asked about that, calling them animals. We've done this before. Called African Americans monkeys and come up with all kinds of animals to refer to certain races. And when asked about it, he goes, it's MS-13, it's MS-13. It's now wait a minute, MS-13.
Sir, could you clarify the context of your use of the word animal yesterday in referring to some people?
Well, it has nothing to do with this meeting, but I'm referring, and you know I'm referring, to the MS-13 gangs that are coming in. And I was talking about the MS-13, and also, and if you look a little bit further on in the tape, you'll see that. So I'm actually surprised you're asking this question, because most people got it right.
Nobody's been a better salesman for MS-13 than has Donald Trump. Nobody has raised their profile quite like Donald Trump has. And it's fairly embarrassing. The country is being terrorized. It's true. We are being terrorized. But it is not by MS-13. Hell, I think most people never even heard of MS-13. Until this guy started singing their songs for them. What we are aware of is all of the white, Christian, conservative males that are walking into our schools with guns and murdering our children. If you really want to stop a terrorist group, might be time to start profiling white people. We'll have to get into that a little bit later. Because the president was able to run on this super racist platform and was able to win on this super racist platform, naturally, the next election that follows somebody like that winning is going to have, you guessed it, a lot of really super racist and this year anti-Semitic candidates. The headline here from Newsweek, Republican Senate candidate who has been who has called for the country to be free from Jews could be Dianne Feinstein's next challenger. The man in question is a gentleman, and I use the term loosely, named Patrick Little, and he's running in California, and he could end up running opposite Dianne Feinstein. And we'll find out here soon, but he's in the lead of all the Republicans that are running. This guy, who is a hardcore anti-Semite and a disciple of David Duke, and who has openly called for the country to be free from Jews, looks like he might win the primary. And if he wins the primary, he likely will not win in the fall. First of all, Dianne Feinstein is an incumbent. But the fact that the Republican Party is even picking that guy just kind of shows you where the GOP is at this time. And before we move on to our next topic, I want to share this with you. So, Chris Wiley, who worked for Cambridge Analytica, and obviously that was Steve Bannon's company, was giving testimony this week, and he was asked if any of what was happening at Cambridge Analytica. Now remember, the guy that owns Cambridge Analytica, Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon was the campaign manager for Trump for a little while. Chris Wiley was asked, was any part of what you were made to do or asked to do, was any part of it racially motivated? Was Cambridge Analytica trying to keep say, African Americans away from voting.
Was one of his goals to suppress voting or discourage certain individuals in the United States from voting?
That was my understanding, yes.
Was voter suppression a service that U.S. clients could request in their contracts with Cambridge Analytica while Bannon was vice president?
Yes. One of the things that did provoke me to leave was the beginnings of discussions about voter disengagement. I have seen documents that reference voter disengagement, and I recall conversations that that it was intended to focus on African American voters.
These are not the headlines that you're going to hear about, but these are the things that are going on right now. From the president reading the snake at his rallies to helping to implement horribly racist policies, to the people in the House and Senate going for those racist policies and now learning more about the 2016 election that was meant to keep African Americans away from the polls. The information is out there and we should all be knowing it. And I have no idea why these aren't the biggest stories in America right now.
An essential tenet of a free society, a free people, is access to the truth. If our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or we as people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on a pathway to relinquishing our freedom.
So the president sent out a tweet this week saying that he hereby demands an investigation into the investigators. And I got an email because I gave $5 to the campaign a couple years ago. I got an email from the Trump Pence campaign, and it says right on it, "Melvin, I hereby demand that the Justice Department investigate whether Obama's FBI and DOJ infiltrated or surveilled our campaign for political purposes." It says, "This could be the greatest political scandal in American history. I need you to sign your name right now and give me some money so that I can keep paying my legal bills." It doesn't say that last part, but that's exactly what's happening with the money. And the headline on the email was "Worse than Watergate." Worse than Watergate. My God. He certainly thinks a lot of himself, doesn't he?
This goes back 100 days before the election. They had spies in the Trump camp. I'm trying to figure out, you know, who was sitting next to me on the airplane. That's Watergate compounded by the fact that we're many years after Watergate and we didn't think this could happen. This is a far worse crime and intrusion on democracy than a non-Russian conspiracy. And who's investigating it? I hope that this is turned over for criminal referral. And I hope for once the Justice Department wakes up and investigates something other than, you know, empowering Mueller to do an illegitimate investigation. It is illegitimate.
And even the president's lawyer, that's Rudy Giuliani, even the president's lawyer is going, "This is like water. It's worse than Watergate." Let us remember what happened during Watergate. I understand that the president wants to cast himself as the victim here, as the guy that is just getting screwed by the fact that he is so awesome, so great, and so right about everything all the time. And he sees not just Watergate, but worse than Watergate. And I suppose I see a little bit of Watergate too. See, Nixon was notorious for using the government to target his political enemies. And I remember hearing about when I was growing up, because we didn't learn about it in school for whatever reason, but I remember hearing about Richard Nixon and the things that he did, and, you know, using parts of the government to get after people that he just did not like. Not because he felt like what they were doing was wrong, but because it was against him. And one of the more famous things that we know about Nixon was that he tried to use his attorney general to go after people because they were involved in Watergate, because they were, he saw them as political enemies. And so he went, there's a very famous call, and I went ahead and I pulled the audio from PBS. And there's a very famous call between him and his attorney general. And I'm going to play the call for you. And in the call, heads up, he uses some racial slurs. He uses a swear, but nothing that I don't use here. But it's so stunning, this party. The racism, they have no problem with the racism. And in the call, you'll hear you'll hear him say, I heard that so-and-so has a gardener that is a racial slur. Go after him. Go after him. Call ICE. All this other stuff. Get after him, because how dare they go after me, Richard Nixon.
I want you to direct the most trusted person you have in the Immigration Service that they are to look over all of the activities of the Los Angeles Times, all underlined, to see whether they are violating the wetback thing. Now, let me explain, because as a Californian, I know everybody in California hires them. There's no law against it because they are there, because for menial things and so forth. Otis Chandler, I want him checked with regard to his gardener. I understand he's a wetback. We're going after the Chandlers, everyone individually, collectively, their income tax. They're starting this week. Every one of those sons of bitches. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
I understand. Do it. Give me a report.
Very well, sir.
Richard Nixon did not care for the Los Angeles Times because that was the media. So this is his way of crying fake news publicly and then behind the scenes getting his attorney general to sic him on the Times. And he didn't just hate them. He also hated the Washington Post because, much like Trump, the Washington Post was reporting things that were accurate and true about the president. And he also went after the Washington Post in the same way. And Trump, if he wants to see Watergate in this, might help him out a little bit. The headline here, from Reuters, Trump urged the U.S. Postal Service to double package rates for Amazon. Hold on. Quoting here, the president has personally pushed the Postmaster General to double the rates for the U.S. Postal Service that the U.S. Postal Service charges Amazon.com and other companies that ship packages. This, according to the Washington Post, citing three unnamed sources. Postmaster General Megan Brennan resisted Trump's suggestion in private conversations in 2017 and 2018, telling him that package delivery rates are set by contract and reviewed by an independent commission, the sources say, according to the paper. So there's a couple things we need to point out here. One, we just learned that he met with the Postmaster General. Everything that the president does is supposed to be on his official schedule. The media gets his official schedule. All of these meetings that we're hearing about with the Postmaster General, none of those ended up on his schedule, and we're only learning about them now because of our sources. And doubling the rates for Amazon, that's a constituency that I don't think that anybody talks about, the people that buy stuff from Amazon. Amazon is not a political company. Everybody buys from Amazon. Democrats, Republicans, independents, black people, white people, men, women. Everybody buys from Amazon. So doubling their rates is not a fantastic idea, especially if it can be traced back to you, Mr. President. But why the hell does he want Amazon's rates to be doubled? Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is the CEO of Amazon. And a couple of years ago, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. He wants the USPS, a government agency, to double the rates on Amazon.com because the same guy that owns Amazon is the same guy that owns the Washington Post, and he does not like what they are reporting about him. He sees Watergate in this. And I want to say, Mr. President, I see Watergate too. Michael Beschloss has got to be one of my favorite historians, not just for his depth of knowledge, but for how clearly he can put this stuff so that everybody understands it. And Mr. Beschloss pointed out something last week that just kind of hit me. And I've always realized it, at least a little bit in one way or another. But when he put it the way he put it, it made me realize that, you know what? Had this particular thing been around at that time, maybe Nixon wouldn't have had to resign. Maybe Nixon would have served out both terms. And maybe we would be naming post offices and streets and people's kids after Nixon. Because history would have recorded what was said on Fox News, what was said on InfoWars, and what was said on right-wing radio, and not what actually happened.
You know, Donald Trump has called this supposed embed by the FBI for political purposes on his campaign, as you said, worse than Watergate. What Nixon did not have was Fox News or Sinclair or big-time conservative media. What he would not have given to be able to take things that came up that were embarrassing or damaging to him, like collusion, and turn it into something else, it might have allowed him to at least delay his move to impeachment.
Speaking of that, the president is going on Fox News regularly. And they're trying to get a little bit of a leash on him. They're trying to get him to calm the hell down and not say too much. But at the same time, giving him a platform that he can say whatever what he wants whenever he wants to.
Look at the corruption at the top of the FBI. It's a disgrace. And our Justice Department, which I try and stay away from, but at some point I won't. Our okay. Justice Department should be looking at that kind of stuff, not the nonsense of collusion right. with Russia.
Oh, and you hear the anchor. Okay. And the beauty here is during the Nixon administration, Roger Ailes, the old CEO of Fox News, used to work for Nixon. And after it happened, I talked about this before. He brought up the idea to Nixon about having a television station that is friendly to the conservative worldview, friendly to conservatives. And of course, at that time, there was really no arm of the government he could use to start that, because that would honestly be propaganda. And he didn't have the money to invest in the channel. Of course, Ailes met with Rupert Murdoch during the 90s, and we now have Fox News because of that. So the dream that they wanted has now been realized, and that dream is now protecting a Nixonian-like president. And so all the things that Roger Ailes dreamed about, how if they just had a media that was friendly to them, you know, maybe Nixon would have had to resign, maybe all this stuff wouldn't have been found out. It's now being tested in front of the American people. Rudy Giuliani is the president's main lawyer on the Russia scandal. And there's an article that came out this week from The Guardian. The headline, Rudy Giuliani won a deal for the OxyContin maker to continue sales of drugs behind the opioid deaths. So dig this. Opioids are a massive problem right now. And it's only getting worse. The maker of OxyContin came out this week and said, these opioid deaths are not just from our drug. It's from heroin and all these other things. And that's true, but it all starts with the drugs that they make. And they were being sued, you know, back during the early 2000s. And it was Giuliani that stepped up and won a case for them so that they could continue selling their drugs on the market. And in turn, Giuliani is now at least somewhat responsible for this opioid problem that Trump is supposedly trying to fight. That's just sort of an interesting side fact. But it's also a tale of two lawyers. On one side, Giuliani, corrupt as the day is long, fought for drug companies, fought for the greedy banks, you know, fought for all these, you know, greedy corporations and economic hitmen, just always on the wrong side of history. Republican. And on the other side, Robert Mueller. Also a Republican, but not on the wrong side of history. On the correct side, where the truth is, one of the harshest critics during the 2016 campaign was Chris Christie. And Chris Christie has joined the president's side after everything. He's a defender of the president and all the rest. But recently, Christie was asked about Mueller. and said, what do you think about Mueller? And the president says, fake news, it's a witch hunt and all this other stuff. What do you think about Mueller? And I think Christie's response is an indication of where we're going with this investigation. Because this is somebody that's really close to the president who is now starting to distance himself from the president.
I've told him many times that there's no way to make an investigation like this shorter, but there's lots of ways to make it longer. And he's executed on a number of those ways to make it longer. Bob Mueller himself is not a partisan. He's an honest guy. He's a hardworking guy. He's smart. And you can't argue that the investigation hasn't been effective so far. Got a number of guilty pleas, a couple of indictments in a year. It's pretty good work. And so I said all along, I don't question Bob Mueller's honesty or his integrity. Never have. And having worked with him for 7 years, I still wouldn't.
Would anybody like to stay at the Trump Watergate Hotel? Trump sees Watergate in everything right now. And he is the victim. And it is we that is guilty of Watergate. It is us. We infiltrated his campaign. He was the victim during the campaign because everything was rigged. And then he won, and he's the victim again because how dare you come after me and tell me that I broke the law? I am the president, and I am above the law. Remember, if the president does it, then it is not illegal. Oh, you're going to get your Watergate, sir. Just you wait.
Words to solve the problem of school violence, the amount of facts, logic, and most importantly, voices that should be heard and weighed but aren't, is laughable. Tragically, 17 innocent lives later, we're still not any closer to solving the problem because, well, agenda. The FBI failed to protect these kids. The sheriff's office failed to protect these kids. School officials failed to protect these kids. And of course, we all know the resource officer blatantly failed to protect these kids. For some reason, none of these egregious failures matter because, well, we know that when a kid is riding his bike down the street and gets hit by a car, it's the NRA's fault. Just this week, a school shooting was stopped before a single innocent life was lost because a good guy with a gun put an end to it. You want to save innocent lives? Take the millions of dollars going to this carnival of a march and hire armed guards in schools all over this country. But then these kids would have to shrink from the spotlight and go back to their homework. And the forces funding them would lose the opportunity to further an agenda that's million times bigger than the guns.
After every single tragedy, the kids that were killed were victims. The kids that survived themselves also become victims. After the Florida shooting, the kids, the surviving kids, the angry surviving kids, and they got every right to be angry, they put together the March for Our Lives. And the NRA began putting out ads calling it the March for Our Lies.
To all the kids from Parkland getting ready to use your First Amendment to attack everyone else's Second Amendment at your march on Saturday, I wish a hero like Blaine had been at Marjorie Douglas High School last month, because your classmates would still be alive and no one would know your names, because the media would have completely and utterly ignored your story. You want to save innocent lives? Take the millions of dollars going to this carnival of a march and hire armed guards in schools all over this country. But then these kids would have to shrink from the spotlight and go back to their homework.
I have a completely insane idea, and I want to bring it to you today. Every one of these school shootings affects me differently. And I respond differently to this one as I did to the last one, as I did to the last one. We're living through an insane time at best. The fact that our children are being slaughtered in their classrooms. And this is America. And we're cool with it. And not only do we not really respond, we go the extra step of offering something completely useless. Thoughts and prayers. There's a variation on that, but by and large, it's thoughts and prayers. The first thing means, I'm thinking about you, which means nothing to you and does nothing for you. And the other thing is prayers. That's us saying that we're going to do nothing. So thoughts, can't feel them. Prayers, not action. The kids after this particular tragedy tried to say, they tried to be diplomatic about it. They tried to say the thoughts and prayers are nice, but please, we would like some action. There's an article that came out from CNN by Chip Grabow and Lisa Rose. It says the U.S. has had 57 times more shootings, more school shootings, as all of the other major industrialized nations combined. Nobody asks why. They say, it's mental health, but let's not do anything about mental health. It's not the guns, and definitely let's not do anything about the guns. 57 times more than the entire world combined. So this is clearly an American problem.
10th grader Dakota Schrader heard the gunshots and ran.
Try to make it to the safest place I could as fast as I can.
She tells KTRK this just can't happen.
I shouldn't be going through this at my school. Like, this is my daily life. I shouldn't have to feel like that.
The Texas attack comes 3 months after a Florida school shooting that killed 17.
This has been going on too long in our country.
At a prison reform event here at the White House, President Trump called it a very sad day.
Everyone must work together at every level of government to keep our children safe.
It's insane that we live in a world where this keeps happening and everybody's okay with it. The folks continue voting for the politicians that want to do absolutely nothing about it. And this one became super egregious because one of the things that we learned about the shooter was he didn't shoot anybody he liked, making it not all that random. And what's worse is one of the people that he decided to shoot was a girl. You want to talk about white privilege. You want to talk about men, white men who feel entitled. If a gun is for protection, then tell me why. This guy decided to shoot the girl that turned him down.
That they are still evaluating to see what type of mental history may have contributed to this, but they say at this point that he seems, quote, confused, that he's still trying to figure out exactly what happened. Also significantly, he says that he doesn't seem to remember the name of Shayna Fisher. Now, she is a 16-year-old, one of the victims, whose mother tells NBC News that she was one of the first people shot in this massacre and that her daughter had rejected Demetrius Pogorchy's advances, she says, over a four-month period, and that she believes that may have contributed to him targeting her. Again, his attorneys deny that at this point. But eyewitnesses tell us of a heart-wrenching scene on Friday where that suspect, according to eyewitnesses, barged into the art classroom and yelled surprise and shot at several of these students. And in between gunshots, according to one survivor, he was singing a song, humming the song, Another One Bites the Dust.
Did you hear that? Did you catch that last part? First of all, he thinks he's in a movie from watching too much television. Kicks in the door, surprise, and starts shooting at people. And in between shots, he's singing a little ditty to himself, humming a little tune. Got a song in his heart. My God, what was that song again?
Eyewitnesses tell us of a heart-wrenching scene on Friday where that suspect, according to eyewitnesses, barged into the art classroom and yelled surprise and shot at several of these students. And in between gunshots, according to one survivor, he was singing a song, humming the song, Another One Bites the Dust.
After these shootings happen, we get nothing from Congress. We get nothing. And then, of course, the NRA attacks the students and attacks anybody and attacks the families, attacks anybody who says anything against our precious, precious guns. Most of those kids from the most recent shooting have already been buried. not even graduated, not old enough to vote. And they're being put into the ground right now. One of the women decided to go back to school. It was a teacher. She decided to start working again because her husband was sick, terminal, with cancer. And she went back to work because, one, she just needed something else other than her cancer-stricken husband in her life. And she also needed money. And she was one of the people that was murdered. Her husband is now alone. She didn't die at her natural time. She went way early. And then of kids. Man, the kids. The kids went super early. And after every one of these events, everybody gets just trashed, torn apart by conservative media, torn apart by gun owners, torn apart by the NRA. So reading an article at the Washington Post that said that 2018, the headline, 2018 has been deadlier for school children than deployed service members. And we've had one school shooting plus for every week of this year, where at least one person was shot in one of our public schools. And the article points out how many people have been killed in school shootings and how many people have been killed while they're deployed. But of course, the Washington Post drew back a little bit and said, well, if you count suicides and some of these other things, obviously war is still a lot deadlier. You consider how many people are in school to how many people are in war. You know, war is still deadlier, but they're trying to make the point. And it hit me. With kids, they spend all, if they get through 13 years of schooling, so K through 12, they get through 13 years of schooling, you know what they get to do next? They get to go to college. And in college, they're going to rack up just a mountain of debt. And there's no guarantee they're going to make it through college either. Remember, we've had first graders slaughtered. We've had college students slaughtered. So you make it through all 13 grades without getting murdered in school. Don't celebrate just yet. You might get murdered in college. One of the things that our service members get is a thing called combat pay. They get a payment because the military is a job. It's an occupation. And then when they go to war, which means they go into a danger zone where they very likely could get killed, they get extra pay for going into that. It's called combat pay. And I was thinking to myself, the only way that we might be able to hit people where it hurts, because they're so resistant to spending money on anything, feeding people, housing people, clothing people, putting people through college. Constituencies are so opposed to paying for anything. Perhaps if there was a threat, a financial threat, that money was going to come out of their pockets, if we didn't do something about this, perhaps more people would get on board. So what am I thinking? I'm thinking about paying students, since schools are now war zones. I'm thinking about giving students combat pay. Oh my God, Melvin, where are you going with this? Follow me. It sounds sick, but if you're not sicked out by the idea of kids being murdered in school, then you got no right to be upset about this. I propose at least $10,000 per child per year for every single year that they are in school. I tell them, I'm pissing people off right now. And that money does not go into their pocket. It goes into a trust, like a 529 plan. And then when they get to college, it's that much more that they won't have to take out in loans. But remember, you can be killed in college too. So you get a $10,000 break for every year. So right off the bat, we're talking a $150,000 break that you get when you get to college, because you got your combat pay for surviving in a public school. It's insane that those words even have to leave my mouth. A lot of folks take out $100,000 in loans. So obviously a lot of this would just be extra for them. Or maybe they could use it for room and board when they go to college. There are a number of them that go out to become a lawyer or become a doctor. And this will super duper help them out. If we start seeing our schools, especially our public schools, as war zones. And not accepting them as war zones, but recognizing that they are. Nobody wakes up. And even when all the school shootings going, I don't think a lot of people wake up and think, is today the day I'm going to die? In my classroom, is today the day that I'm going to die? You're not going to Iraq. You're not going to Afghanistan. You're going into your own classroom. And it seems that the politicians, the conservative politicians that we continue to send to D.C. and to the state houses, they are paralyzed to do anything to help anybody ever, especially when it comes to the subject of murder weapons, of guns. Perhaps if they were having to pay students to attend school, money that goes towards college, perhaps if we gave kids combat pay, maybe then people begin realizing what a problem this really is. Because if dead children aren't enough to motivate you, then perhaps the fact that you might have to pay a little bit more in taxes, that you might have to invest in the future of America, you might have to invest in our country, you might have to invest in our students. Perhaps that, my conservative friends, will piss you off enough that you'll want to do something about the fact that our children are being murdered in their classrooms. But this tragedy, just like every other tragedy, the very, very first thing I hear about, the very first thing, is we need more guns. And we need to start with arming teachers.
Tonight I'm obsessed with questions, a lot of them. Questions that show how complicated it would be to implement the president's idea to arm some teachers with guns. And these are questions that would need to be tackled by every school board and every PTA across the country. Questions about how it would really work if teachers were carrying concealed guns in schools. We've got a lot of questions, but here are just some, in no particular order, that every school board needs to have answered. What type of gun would teachers carry? How much ammo per teacher? Who pays for the guns? Who trains the teachers with the guns? Who certifies the teachers with guns? How much more money do teachers with guns make than teachers without guns? Do all the teachers know which teachers are carrying? Do all the students know which teachers are carrying? Where are the guns stored? Does each classroom have a gun safe? Who knows the code to the gun safe besides the teacher? What happens to the guns overnight? Would armed schools now need 24/7 armed security to protect their guns? Is this just for high schools? What about elementary schools? What about preschools? Will armed teachers be present on field trips, at after-school activities, at sporting events, at school, sports practices, at music recitals, at school plays? Can a teacher lose his or her concealed carry status if he or she has disciplinary problems? How about domestic problems? Will parents need to sign waivers in case their children are accidentally shot by teachers? Can we rely on teachers to be able to shoot one of their colleagues if they lose it? Can we rely on teachers to be able to shoot a student? None of these are easy questions.
A good guy with a gun, stopping a bad guy with a gun, is a terrific pitch for selling two guns. And the idea of arming teachers is only going to sell more guns, and it's not going to solve the problem. And when it doesn't solve the problem and casualties go up, the argument will be the guns aren't big enough, they don't have enough ammo, and even more teachers, because remember, only certain teachers, maybe they said 1 in 10 teachers, right? Only certain teachers need to. There's never going to be enough. If you armed every single man, woman, child, and infant, it wouldn't be enough. There's always going to be a pitch for more guns. Well, maybe Sparky needs to have a gun attached to his collar that when he barks vigorously, it starts shooting and randomly in all directions. Eventually, it's going to hit the bad guy. Everybody, all the time. Bam, bam, bam. Yeah, I get worked up over this. And I say some pretty nutty things. I think the fact that I'm suggesting combat pay for our students, it's about the craziest thing that I have said yet. But it's not the craziest thing that has been said recently on media, any media. The president wants to arm teachers. The NRA wants victims to shut the hell up and take their bullets like a man. Or, better yet, go buy yourself a gun so you can send bullets back in the other direction. Yeah, what I'm saying is nuts. And in any other civilized nation, those words likely wouldn't leave anyone's mouth unless that person was in a mental institution. But I'm saying it here, and I'm saying it now, and I'm not being facetious. I'm not trying to be funny, not trying to be cute. I think that this should honestly be policy. You could say, but that would be us accepting the fact that shootings are going to happen in schools. This is just the way things are. Yeah, this is just the way things are. Because you, as voters, refuse to stop voting for the people that are voting for the slaughter of your children. So if you're going to keep sending the same dingbats back to Congress, if you're okay with public schools becoming war zones where teachers are armed and shooting at students, then you can't possibly think that my idea is all that bad. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes or at Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There, you can also subscribe so you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement here for me. If you think my ideas are insane, tell me my ideas are insane. You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing. What up, Kev? Thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.